So one of the main goals of the center, one area that we've attempted to crystallize some research around, is this issue about how regular temporal structure in the world can be efficiently encoded by the brain in order to sense things like temporal patterns in the world in order to guide behavior. And what I'm going to do today is give you an overview of two projects that are being done in my lab and in Ken Harris's lab at Rutgers that address different aspects of this question about how temporal structure in the world is represented in the brain in terms of spike trains of neurons in ways that can be decoded by the rest of the brain. So part one is going to be in work from our lab about how the temporal precision of spiking in somatosensory cortex is important for decoding basic elements of tactile input trains into the brain. And this is work done by a number of students in the lab, and I'm going to focus today on work primarily by Jason Wolf and Shantanu Jadhav. So the whiskers are an active system, which I can show you here if I get out of PowerPoint for a second. Oh, can you see it? Okay. So here's a rat whisking in space. This is slowed down about tenfold. The whiskers are moved back and forth to sample things. They function like fingertips. They're tactile detectors that reach out and touch objects in the world. And you can imagine how if there was a plane in front of the animal that the whiskers were moving against, as the whisker interacts with that surface or that plane, there would be a temporal series of interactions that would provide continuous input to the animal about the object of interest, the surface of interest. And we wanted to understand how this information was encoded, and really at the most fundamental level, thinking about temporal patterns in the world, is there something, a real something that's temporal information conveyed in the tactile system that needs to be encoded in the somatosensory cortex in a way similar to what we might think of in terms of audition or vision in the presence and the coding of those sensory sequences in the brain. Now, here's an animal using this kind of strategy to gain some information about a surface. This is a rat. He's palpating onto two sandpapers, a rough one on this side and a smooth one on this side, changing randomly from trial to trial, and he's trained to feel with the whiskers and to jump on the rough side to get reward. And so by moving their whiskers across surfaces, rats can distinguish different textures with about the same resolution as human fingertips. How do they do this? Well, at the most basic level, physical characteristics of the surface need to be transformed into a pattern of movements or kinetics of the whiskers, and those whisker kinetics should contain information about the roughness, in this case, of a surface. And then those whisker movements are then translated by transduction, neural transduction, and then really up to the somatosensory cortex into spike trains in the cortex, which presumably encode the relevant features of the stimulus. Now, what the physical transformation is between surfaces and whiskers and what the neural transformation is between those whisker movements and spiking has really not been known. And I'm going to summarize some work we've done over the past few years showing that there's some very interesting aspects of this which very closely relate to time. Firstly, in the physical transformation from surface to whiskers, it turns out that whisker movement across a surface discretizes that whisker movement into a series of transient high-velocity events, and that these events are elements that are then encoded by neurons in somatosensory cortex. And when that coding occurs, time is very important there as well, for reasons that you'll see that precise timing of spikes seems to be critical for encoding these elements of tactile stimulation. So how do we study this? We train animals to stick their nose in one little region of a cage and to whisk back and forth on surfaces that we put in front of them. And as they do this, we cast a plane of laser light down over the whiskers to measure the shadows of those whiskers moving on to a little one-dimensional imaging array so that we get very high spatial and temporal resolution movies of how the whiskers move on surfaces. And while we're doing that, we record with tetrodes from spiking of cells in S1 cortex to see how those little whisker movements are encoded. So you've heard about the motion capture facility here. This is our rodent motion capture facility, our RomoCap. Okay. Here's a view of a subject in the RomoCap. He's going to come forward, stick his nose in the nose poke, whisk back and forth on this sandpaper. He's trimmed down to only have one whisker long enough to touch the surface, and that whisker here goes forward, back, and then he leaves. So two little quick whisks. Now, during that time, even though the motion looks continuous here, when you look at it carefully with the imaging array, it's not continuous. Here's the whisker. This is position on this axis, time here. whisker being pulled back across the surface and then forced forward. And you can see that during the forward motion, the whisker rapidly slips to one position where it sticks for a while, and then it slips again to a new position where it sticks again, and then slips and sticks, etc. And these slip-stick events turn out to be very prominent features of whisker movement on surfaces. Now, we know a lot about how these occur, and I won't bore you with the details, but they occur simply because of friction. As the whisker tries to move across the surface, the animal's trying to push it forward, friction sticks the whisker, and the animal has to apply a certain amount of forward force to overcome that static friction, and then the whisker can move rapidly to a new position where it sticks again. So it's really friction that does it. Okay, now, we thought these were interesting because thinking about the problem about how tactile information is gathered from surfaces, like for surface roughness, it's been sought after in the field for a number of years. What is the cue that the whiskers know about the surface that can actually track roughness? And it turns out that these slips are a great cue. Here is the motion of one whisker for an animal whisking in air, back and forth, onto a smooth sandpaper and onto a rough sandpaper. On the bottom, I'm plotting the acceleration that corresponds to this position. And you can see, for example, on the rough sandpaper, there are a lot of places where the whisker rapidly slips to a new location, and this corresponds to a high transient and acceleration. On smooth sandpapers, there are fewer of those events, and in air, there are essentially none of those events, right? And that's just because the rough sandpapers have more friction. And so a large number of measures that compare the size or occurrence of these slips turn out to track texture. For example, the ratio of how many big, fast slips do you get versus small or slow slips, you get more fast slips on the roughest papers and systematically less on the smoothest paper. So we were interested in this because these discrete events look like they might be interesting cues for surface properties. Now, are these actually encoded by the nervous system? We implanted tetrode recording arrays in the cortex and isolated spikes of single units as the animals did the task. And this meant that we could follow spike trains of single S1 neurons and look at both their background or spontaneous firing and also how they encode these little slip events in the whiskers. And so here's an example for one neuron of a spike train over time. Each little vertical dash is a spike. And this is for an animal that is coming in and doing a whole bunch of whisking trials onto these surfaces, separated by times where he goes back to drink out of a drink port or roll around on the ground or lick or try to escape and all the other things they do. And we, if you look over time at the firing of these neurons, neurons in primary somatosensory cortex in these awake behaving rats have sort of low to moderate background firing rates of a median of about 6 to 8 hertz. This corresponds to single spikes occurring every 150, 120, or 150 milliseconds. They're not bursting while they're doing this. They're producing a train of pup-da-pup-pup-pup single spikes. Okay. What happens when the animal whisks on a surface? Here's one of those acceleration traces of a whisker moving across a surface with a slip event followed about 50 milliseconds later by another slip event, and this one is followed by oscillatory accelerations, which are actually the whisker ringing at its resonance frequency and settling down in the stick, and then a gap, and then another slip event with rings, and another slip event, et cetera. So we can line up all the spike trains of neurons that we get on those slip events, and that's what's shown here for one neuron, okay? 200 slip events, rasters of one neuron, the slip occurs at the red line, and so if the slips drive spikes, you should see extra spikes in the period after the line. And if you look at that very carefully, there is actually an increase in evoked spiking there, but it's very, very sparse. This is the sum of that at the bottom. So statistically, slips do drive a significant increase in firing rate. Okay, it's very transient, but it occurs. Two more examples of that. If we look across all the neurons that we recorded, which are all in layer 4 and layer 5 of the cortex, this is a dominant aspect of responsiveness in the cortex in that 70% of neurons show a significant response peak after these slips. So these slips are being encoded, but they're encoded very sparsely, and also turns out they're encoded with a high temporal precision. The median width of these response peaks when they occur is 14 milliseconds. So if the responses are so sparse, this poses a puzzle. If you're listening to the spike train of a neuron that's popping along every 120 milliseconds spontaneously with single spikes, and then a slip drives one more spike in that spike train, you would never know whether that spike was due to a slip or not. So a single neuron is really not an accurate encoder of a single slip on a single trial. And this is a classic example where perhaps a population can encode things. So when we quantify this, we can actually measure in the 20 millisecond period after slips, what's the probability of either seeing one, two, or more than two spikes in that little window. And it turns out that mostly you see single spikes. The total probability of evoking any number of spikes at all is 0.3. That is, only every 0.3 slips do you see any spike on average in that neuron. In contrast, if you pick a random 20 millisecond window or one right before the slip, there's already a 20% chance of seeing a spike. And so what the slips do is they elevate the spiking rate by about 10%. So this is a very sparse signal in this ongoing background noise in the cortex. How on earth can these be detected? Well, we simulated the population of neurons in S1. We recorded these in little clusters of four or five neurons at the same time with tetrodes, and then serially over many recording sites in several animals. And so we actually didn't measure the spiking of a large population of neurons simultaneously in one trial. But if we make the assumption that neurons fire independently, then we can simulate those 90 neurons that we did record as if they were in one population at the same time. And we do that by modeling each neuron with the actual experimentally measured slip-induced PSTH that we measured for that neuron, and then we can ask how many spikes would that neuron, now 90 neurons in our population, simulating a single trial, 90 neurons, what's the probability that that neuron would produce a spike in the 20 milliseconds before a slip versus after a slip by drawing from the measured response probabilities? Okay, and in doing that, we can then generate, now in computer simulation, a prediction of the spiking that would occur in response either before a slip or after a slip to our population of 90 neurons. Now, can the brain detect a signal there? We can use ROC analysis, which is a statistical way of asking whether there's a detectable difference in the population activity in this window versus this window. And we need a measure of population activity to work on, and so we choose the simplest possible measure. And that is, if there were a neuron that were just summing all the spikes that occurred in this window and adding them up, and summing all the spikes that occurred in this window and adding them up, how accurate would the network be at knowing whether or not a slip occurred based on the size of this response, the number of spikes versus that number of spikes beforehand? Okay. And it turns out that doing this simulation, you can simulate with any number of neurons you want in the population, these are very salient signals. So that a small population of 100 neurons turns out to accurately encode the presence of slips to about 97% accuracy. Okay, and we can also play with the time window that we use. That was 20 milliseconds I just showed you, but we can vary that. And it turns out that 20 milliseconds is indeed the optimal time window for making that prediction. What does this mean? This means that at the population level, if there are elements that can pay attention to the number of spikes being fired in narrow windows, that is, firing correlations in narrow windows or synchrony of firing in narrow windows, then those operators would have the ability to detect slips at this very, very precise level. So this suggests that there may be a code for slips in the transient firing correlations or synchrony of spiking. Now, is this really true? We can go back to our data set and look at those populations of neurons that really were recorded simultaneously from our tetrodes and ask if it's true. So here are two raster plots of two different neurons in two different colors, all again aligned at 100 different slips. And we've boxed in the times where those two neurons fire within 20 milliseconds of each other. Before the slip, there's only occasional places where the neurons fire within 20 milliseconds of each other, but afterwards, there's a much larger number of those synchronous firing events. And if we quantitate this over many different cell pairs, there's an increase in firing synchrony after slips versus before slips. So it really is true that slips raise firing synchrony. Is this slip-driven firing synchrony useful for anything for the animal in terms of decoding overall surface properties? Well, I told you before that as you go to systematically rougher surfaces, there are systematically more large slips. The large slips are much better at driving synchronous spikes than are the weak slips, and so you would predict that maybe there would be more slip-driven synchronous spikes here than there are here, and maybe there'd be even less in air where the whisker's not slipping at all. And so we could compute this, and this is what's shown at the bottom, for animals that are whisking in interleaved ways in between air and a rough surface and a smooth surface, and we can calculate just what's the mean firing rate of neurons on those surfaces, and indeed, neurons fire more on rough surfaces than they do on smooth surfaces, than they do in air, consistent with these slips driving more spikes than these do. But in addition, if we look at the firing correlations in sliding 20 millisecond windows, look at the synchrony, indeed, there's much greater synchrony on the rough surface than on the smooth surface than in air, and the signal to noise of this firing correlation measure is much more than the overall mean firing rate measure, suggesting that correlations on that timescale are important. And as a further suggestion they're important, we can actually look at fine grades of different sandpapers. And here we've chosen four sandpapers, P 150, 400, 800, 1200. These range from sort of medium to fine sandpapers you would use in your house. And this corresponds, the differences between each one of these adjacent sandpapers corresponds to about the psychophysical threshold for a rat in being able to make a roughness discrimination. And when we look at firing rate across these now very similar sandpapers, there's no significant difference in firing rate, but there is a significant difference in firing correlation in these narrow windows. Okay. So this very rapid summary, I apologize for how rapid it is, suggests that continuous tactile sampling, in this case by moving a whisker across a surface, is in fact transformed into a discrete time series of events, the slips on surfaces, and that these slips are fundamental encoded elements of tactile sensation. Now, as far as TDLC goes, we were very excited by this because it means that we now have the opportunity in the somatosensory system to ask, are sequences of these discrete events important in somatic sensation? And if so, how does the brain encode sequences, which is the long-term goal of this project? Now, these individual elements, though, before we even get to sequences, we've discovered are represented by this sparse, low probability, precisely timed spike code, where an individual event has a very low probability of driving a spike. So this is an example of sparse coding. Many of you who deal with cortical sensory coding might be familiar with the idea of sparse coding. This is a very different kind of sparse coding than has been suggested in other systems. In most other systems, like visual cortex, sparseness arises from having neurons that are very tightly tuned for specific stimuli, but respond strongly to those stimuli when they do spike, right, when they do respond. And as a result, you get very few spikes over averaged over a long time out of each neuron. Here we have neurons that are pretty broadly tuned. I didn't show you the data, but these neurons respond to basically any deflection of the whisker that occurs. But they respond at only a very low probability. So you get a small number of spikes now from very broadly tuned neurons. And we think this would be a particularly useful type of encoding for encoding temporally dense sensory streams where there is a very rapid sequence of salient events coming in to a broadly tuned detector. If you don't want your spikes and your synapses to adapt away to nothing, you need to have a low response probability to maintain that. So what we've shown is that temporal precision in the responses allows efficient decoding of that very sparse activity, and this may be useful for representing dense input streams. So in ongoing questions, I've already hinted at this, we want to know, do specific sequences of whisker stimuli carry behavioral meaning? Can tactile sequences in the whisker system be learned, which is actually not known yet? And how are these sequences represented in the brain, which we have a little bit of information on? In the last 5 minutes or so, I also want to review some work done by Ken Harris's lab that asks a different aspect of this question. We've been talking about how sensory input drives a neural response and how temporal information here is encoded. But of course, neural responses don't occur on a quiet background, but instead there are this very robust and interesting internal dynamics in terms of oscillations and other features like Tony Bell alluded to in the cortex. And these internal dynamics are both created by the neural responses that come in and also are created by larger scale top-down issues like behavioral and attentional states that then influence the neural responses that are generated. So if you want to understand how temporal information or any information here is encoded, you need to understand the interaction between this input and the internal dynamics. And that's what the Harris Lab has been focused on. They've been measuring local field potentials. This is not their figure, but it illustrates the point, from auditory cortex, and they're studying responses to auditory stimuli. And they're interested in auditory encoding in two different states. In an activated state in the cortex, which is a high-frequency, low-amplitude, desynchronized LFP or EEG, corresponding to alert wakefulness or REM sleep in normal people and animals, versus in an activated state, which is lower frequency, higher amplitude rhythm, which certainly corresponds to some aspects of sleep and perhaps also to inattentive wakefulness. And this is just to illustrate for those of you who haven't seen this. Here's a local field potential measured, in this case, in somatosensory cortex in an anesthetized animal. But as that animal goes in and out of inactive and active states, you can switch from the slow, high-amplitude inactive state to a more desynchronized active state. Okay, so their experiment is to apply two clicks, one here and one here, and measure neural responses recorded from multi-site recording probes in A1 and divide up the, this is in urethane anesthetized animals, and either spontaneous transition between these states or stimulated transition between the states from brainstem stimulation. And they're going to divide up the analysis into responses when the brain was in an inactivated state versus an activated state. And if you consider just single clicks, which is shown here on the top, in the inactivated state, you get responses. In the activated state, you get responses as well. If you look at sequences of clicks, here two clicks 50 milliseconds apart, then in the inactivated state, there's a nice representation of the first click, but the representation of the second click becomes very unreliable in time and reduced in amplitude and lost compared to in the activated state where there's a much more efficient representation of that second click. This is another example of the same thing. Looking at this a little bit more closely, if you apply pairs of clicks and now look at the response to that pair of clicks, either when this was the first click being delivered, and here if you calibrate these correctly, in the inactivated state, you can get good responses to the first click and decent responses to the second. But if these responses follow a previous event that has already generated the response in the cortex, then now your first click you apply generates only an unreliable response, and your second one basically nothing at all. However, in the activated state, that second click is still capable of driving strong responses, again, suggesting that the reliability of responsiveness, particularly now to temporal series, to sequences, is enhanced in the activated state. And using a computational approach, they can ask how well does the spiking actually predict what the stimulus was? That is, can you predict whether a click occurred or hadn't occurred using similar kinds of techniques to what I told you before for the whisker system? And in fact, when you make predictions from spikes in the activated state, you get a much better predictive ability than you do when you make predictions in the inactivated state, because this is a highly reliable spike response. This is an unreliable spike response. And this extends to thinking about the precise timing of spikes in cortex as well. Here they're applying a noise stimulus that's amplitude modulated in time, so getting louder, softer, louder, softer, louder, softer rapidly over time. And they're measuring the spiking response to this from multiple units, either when the brain is in an activated state or in the inactivated state. And what I think you can see just by looking at how the spikes line up, in the activated state, spikes are nicely driven in a synchronized way, in a way that's time-locked to the stimulus. That is, the spikes that are being induced with high temporal precision, whereas in the inactivated state, there's a lot more variability that occurs. And you can even see this in the LFP. That is, the LFP, remember I mentioned these internal dynamics are being affected not just by behavioral state, but also by the sensory input. And so in the activated state, the LFP itself locks to the stimulus. This is coherence between the LFP and the stimulus. Whereas in the inactive state, there's a much poorer locking, particularly at higher frequencies. So the model that the Harris Lab is developing from this is that these measurements of sensory encoding in activated and inactivated states in anesthetized animals may be taken as a proxy, at least an experimental proxy for now, for the brain activity that exists in awake animals in the attentive state versus the inattentive state, so that by studying this in an experimental prep, we may learn about the importance of cortical dynamics in regulating the reliability of sensory inputs in general. So trying to unite both of these studies, conclusions and challenges, spike timing carries important information about low-level sensory features. And I feel like I really should emphasize that we're talking about whisker slips and clicks, right? These are low-level features. But just at this level and just in primary sensory cortex, it's already clear that precise timing on the 20-ish millisecond timescale is critical for that sensory encoding. Local internal dynamics influence the timing of spikes and the reliability of spikes in a profound way. And this is actually an observation that has been made with other techniques for many, many years, but I think now we have experimental tools to really go in and figure out how this is quantitatively affecting the coding in ways that can be related to awake behaving animals and even make those measurements in awake behaving animals. I would pose a question, and this is a question that people in other projects within Initiative One are addressing, and which is one of our long-term goals that we want to address here. Do S1 and A1, or for that matter, V1, or other low-level processing areas in the brain, do they have similar coding strategies for sequences, or are we going to find fundamental differences between the modalities? Auditory cortex is often discussed as having a unique ability to recognize and process temporal information, which of course is important for speech and many things. But is this really a unique ability of A1, or is this a general ability of low-level cortical processing networks? And I think that's what we hope to find out by looking across these different systems. Whether the coding is similar or not, how does it influence encoding and perception of these patterns and sequences? So these are the big questions. Thank you very much. Howard.
One whisker at a time, and of course there, I don't know how many whiskers a rat has, five or something. Are these moving in lockstep, or can they move independently like the fingers? And how are the projections from each whisker to the various somatosensory neurons organized? And could you look at sequences not just of one whisker over time, but all five whiskers together as a synergy?
Yeah, we started off, so rats have about 30 whiskers on each side of the face. And most of the time when rats move them, they move their whiskers as if we were moving our whole arm like this. So they're moving in parallel in the face. However, under certain behavioral conditions, it's absolutely clear that the animals can move some whiskers differently from each other. From a purely behavioral point of view, we don't know yet what type of information the animal's gathering in one of those exploration modes versus the other mode. Now, technically, it's much easier for us to measure. So each of those whiskers maps onto one column in the cortex in a very beautiful way, which is actually why we're doing that in this system. And so we've simplified the problem by looking at one whisker. But right now, we're starting some experiments to look at multiple whiskers. When they do slip, they slip in a roughly coherent way within maybe about 20 milliseconds of each other. So it is quite possible that spatial and temporal summation across those whiskers adds up to bigger and maybe even more precisely timed responses. I'm not sure when you look at multiple whiskers. So we'll see.
Have you ever cross-tied whiskers so that a whisker that was on the left is now on the right of another one, and how would that affect perception?
We have been thinking about that experiment for many years in terms of plasticity, but unfortunately rats are very finicky about their whiskers, and they will not tolerate having their whiskers glued together. They're remarkable groomers.
You were speaking as if the only information coming is from the deflection of the whisker. But I'm thinking there might also be information from motor cortex about how much pressure is being applied, and that might account for some of your variation.
Yeah, so we certainly think that the input coming to the whiskers is a complex input. You can have tangential forces, you know, on the whisker. You can have drag. You can have bending of the whisker. You can have these rapid slip events.
No. I meant the information coming to the cortex.
Right, and in the cortex also, not only is there, we know there's a very strong direct input from motor cortex, but from many other animals. And actually, because of that, I didn't show you this data, but we can count the number of spikes that are being driven by these slips as the animals whisk on surfaces, and they represent 30% of the total spiking induced on surfaces. And in my view, in an awake behaving animal doing a complicated task where we're not even controlling the task, the animal is whisking on its own, it's remarkable to me that we can explain 30% of the variance from just this one kinematic feature. But I fully expect that there will be other spikes driven by many other things.
Did you actually check to see how many synchronous spikes would be expected given the changes in firing rate?
Yeah, so I didn't mention this as well. We actually think these neurons are completely independent, and what the slips are doing is transiently increasing firing rate independently between neurons, and the amount of synchrony that we see is exactly what you'd expect from independent firing. In fact, we have very strong evidence that these are really acting independently.
But is it transient on like 20 millisecond time scale?
It is. That's the remarkable thing.